Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to a Let's Talk show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. Today is the eve of Budget 2019, but we're not going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about the larger political framework in which all these things are happening. Needless to say, we're going to be looking forward to our full-on programming tomorrow on Budget 2019, as it is the first indicator of how this government is going to put into practice some of its stated policies. I have with me Azmi Sharom. He is a professor of law at University of Malaya, and also Janabah Sadiq, who's the founder of the Malaysian Insight. Of course, he's well known for the Malaysian Insight that came before that. And they're both people I've known for many decades. Excited to have you on my show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Mahathir gave his cabinet a report card. He's graded them, I think, rather badly. Maybe he's a bit too harsh. Something of the stern schoolmaster in him. But I want to turn to you to look at the public. Now, how would you rate them, or us rather, in the last 6 months that we've had, Jabba?
Well, I'd follow Dr. Mahathir. I think the Malaysian public did very poorly. We expect an instant noodle country. We thought we changed the government on May 9th, and everything else would flow immediately. It takes time, and we need to give time, but we don't. You know, I think we're just a country that just wants to outsource everything and get it done yesterday.
Yesterday. Okay, so it's a C minus for patience, is it?
D.
D for patience. okay. You actually do grade people.
Yes,
on a daily basis, or maybe weekly, or by the semester. What's your sense of the Malaysian public's response to this new government?
Well, I'm a lot more generous. You know, I generally try not to fail people. So I suppose I'll give it a B.
That's pretty good.
Well, okay, because firstly, there is a lot of interest. And there is a lot of people pushing their agenda, trying to keep the government on its toes, which doesn't really happen usually, right? Maybe it's still the whole euphoria thing. It's, you know, and people are overexcited. And yes, they're impatient. Everybody thinks that their particular bugbear has to be settled now, which is, of course, ridiculous. But it's still healthier to have some sort of engagement from the public with the government.
I mean, you did say recently, I was quoted in some of the papers, that some people have started to treat Dr. Mahathir, who helms this government, as if he got his mandate from heaven, as opposed to getting it from the public or the populace or of voters. Can we sort of disaggregate this government? I mean, there is Dr. Mahathir, there is his cabinet, there is parliament.
Yeah. And there's a civil service.
And there's a civil service. Yeah. So how would you start to kind of work through that? I mean, do you think Dr. Mahathir, at this point in time, is kind of a Teflon prime minister? He can do no wrong.
At this point in time, yes. I mean, you know, he's said a few controversial things, but we haven't wrapped him on the knuckles for it. I think we are a bit more forgiving for him because of what happened on May 9th. That he, the architect of what happened before me 9 years ago, managed to topple the Barisan National Government. So we give him a lot of leeway for that. But we are a bit more strict with the rest of the government, you know, the DAP, Amanah, because they've been saying a lot through the years. And now that they're in government, they should be performing. I think Parliament just had one session. I can't really say anything except I get the sinking feeling that Pakatan Harapan, at most parts, it's like Barisan National in the ruling benches. The civil service, I think the jury's out on them, whether they're actually performing. They looked the other way before May 9th. They're not looking any which way right now, in my estimate. I think it'll take some time.
Okay, time. The comment that you made about Dr. Mahathir, do you think it still stands? It was several months ago, in fact. Mm. Do you see that slowly changing as people come to realize that they need to hold him as well to account?
Well, you know what Malaysians are like, right? You know, we always are looking for some hero. And then suddenly this, you know, really ancient hero comes back from a land beyond time. And then, you know, everybody latches on. Yeah. And it's actually very typical of Malaysian behavior, you know, this hero worship, looking for someone you can turn to. He will or she will solve everything for you. You know, and also I think a lot of the older people feel vindicated because these were the lot who supported Barisan and Mahathir in the 80s, yeah, when all the groundwork for all the stuff or all the problems that we have, the judiciary, the institutions, all that was laid when the older generation was supporting this guy, yeah. right? And then suddenly he's back, and suddenly he's the father of democracy or whatever, and then suddenly all these older chaps feel vindicated. Oh, yeah, yeah, this is great, you know?
So deeply ironic, right, in some ways.
Extremely ironic.
Okay, but the future actually belongs to the young, the new generation who perhaps didn't grow up during the Mahathir era and don't know his checkered legacy, as it were. Yeah. Do you think they will change the terms of engagement with their government moving forward, whether it's Dr. Mahathir or it's Anwar who succeeds it, or moving forward?
I think for sure they will change the terms. And as I was saying earlier, we're going to get a younger electorate. If the rule change goes through that the 18-year-olds can vote, they're going to demand more because they are also an instant satisfaction kind of people. So they want everything off an app, 1-2 taps, get it done. You know, order things through any app whatsoever and get it delivered in their house in 3 days' time. So they will demand more from this government going forward.
But also, I don't think they care as much about parties.
Yeah.
Because they don't have that kind of hang. I mean, like people of my generation, you know, if you were against the government 2 decades ago, I mean, this is some heavy baggage you're carrying.
Yeah.
You know, it's very difficult to suddenly go around and say, yes, well, the opposition are doing a good job. It's very hard. You know, but the younger generation, they don't have that baggage. They are coming into a political scene where they are seeing a possible fight between two groups, whereas we are used to a scene where one group was just all powerful, right? So it's a very different dynamic for them.
Okay, but there's also, they might be demanding, but there's something that democracy demands of people too. Not simply to you know, to be engaged and do the kinds of things you're saying, not having party loyalty, because is one aspect of it. But what about the heavy lifting that people have to do as citizens to read, to find out about policies, to, in fact, perhaps go to the polls more than once every 5 years for a plebiscite or for a referendum to actually be engaged. It is very demanding on your time.
Good point. But, you know, talk about policies. Have there been any great policies in the last 6 months? The Port Dickson by-election was about a man re-entering parliament. Nothing about policy, unfortunately. And the Liberals were unfairly maligned, but I mean, can always go and debate about this. They themselves had no policy. You know, they just talk about new politics and old politics. So I agree with you. Yeah, policies are very important, but we haven't seen much. And also the younger folks, the generation after us, I don't think they have fully formed what policies are, or do they even read, you know, anything.
Okay, so do you, I mean, you work with young people, obviously, in universities. I mean, just your that's your burden.
Hang out with them.
But you talk to them, I mean, I'm sure, you know, occasionally. The issue, do you think, at least not all of them, but a good number of them understand what democracy means in terms of their personal responsibility?
Well, okay, it's very unfair. Firstly, because I only really deal with law students in University of Malaya, so they're the creme de la creme of Malaysia. And yes, they are generally quite well-read, they're generally opinionated, and their opinions are pretty good. You know, they have pretty good opinions, well-founded opinions, but we're really talking about a very small percentage of the youth. If you're talking about the broader picture, it's not just the youth. I mean, you know, I think this whole embracing of ignorance is something which happens all over the world. This is a problem which is worldwide. It's not just us. How on earth did Trump get elected if people actually stopped to think?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But perhaps, you know, if you have a substantial minority of people who are tuned in, who are, understand, who are willing to do the thinking that's necessary to at least lead their societies, do you think that's happening? Are you pessimistic or optimistic?
I'm optimistic. It is happening in urban areas. But the tendency is for them then to impose their views on the larger public, the ones beyond the Klang Valley. I mean, Bangsa, for instance, the Bangsa people.
The Bangsa bubble, is that what you're going to say?
Okay. Yeah, but Bangsa bubble. But then you go across the federal highway, you've got the Pantai Dalam bubble, right? So two different sets of thinking divided by a highway. And no one's trying to reach out to each other. They're trying to impose their views on each other. The guys in Kelantan and Terengganu try to impose their conservative views on us. And we are trying to tell them that they are puritanical and outdated and should get on with the program. But we're just shouting at each other. We're not engaging each other, trying to figure out why they think that way.
Okay, we're going to have to take a break now, and we're going to be right back with more on Let's Talk With Me, Sharad Kutin. Hi, and welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. In the studio tonight, I have Jabir Sadiq. He's the founder of and the man who works the levers at the Malaysian Insight. Also, Azmi Sharam, who's a professor of law at University of Malaya, who's talking to us about how he leads a class of the creme de la creme of the country. So I'm sure there are a lot of young people out there cheering you on. You know, in 2014, I think 200 students and academics marched for you because you were charged with sedition.
Yes, sir.
All right? And this new government had promised to remove the Sedition Act. But yet we have, over and over again, just a couple of days ago, a PKR member of parliament, PKR, the party that forms a coalition that controls, calling for the Sedition Act to be used against somebody who's a spokesperson for or a press advisor to the Prime Minister. Exactly. It's an extraordinary moment. Again, I think Gobind Sindhio, the minister in charge of communications, has come out to say, no such thing, we're not going to be using the Sedition Act. So what this confusion and this love of the Sedition Act, the man who's faced the not the gallows, but you faced it, the serious charges.
Malaya Law Lecturer,
why?
Associate Professor Dr.
Why?
Azmi Sharam. Has
I don't
been
know. I mean, did he not read the manifesto? And did he not hear what was announced, that they were going to have a moratorium on all sedition-type cases, right? They're not going to use the law. I mean, it looks extremely political in the cheapest, shallowest sense. Surely this guy knows what's in that manifesto. Surely he's heard Gobind say, we're not going to use it. And then you come up and say, we're going to use it for this guy. I mean, it's quite ridiculous. I don't know why. I mean,
do you have... There must be some conspiracy theories floating around about this.
I think Azmi's right. It's completely political. Maybe they're chafing at their bit because one guy's from PKR.
From Kedah. And
from
so
Kedah.
He feels that, in some ways, the sovereign of Kedah has been maligned and he wants...
Well, I think that's his excuse. Really,
he wants to get Kadir.
He wants to get Kadir, right? For reasons known to himself, because maybe Kadir is closely aligned to Dr. Mahathir, and Dr. Mahathir's son is the chief minister of Kedah, and this PKR MP wanted to be the chief minister of Kedah.
No, I didn't know that.
He wanted to.
Well, everybody's got ambitions. Now, okay, so the article or the blog post rather in question is called "Rakyat Perlu Tahu Peruntukan Belanja Buat Raja." Or, translated, the people need to know about the allocations for rulers. So this is also a kind of a theme, at least for Kadir Jassid. You know, he did, in fact, release something with regard to the current Agong, and now the Sultan of Kedah. Is this seditious, Azmi?
Well, I don't want to say whether it is or not, because I want to get rid of that law forever. I don't want us to ask that question anymore. Yeah. But if you look at the Sedition Act, it is so broad that it could be considered seditious, because if it's done in a way which makes you unhappy that the royal families are getting so much money, then it is raising disaffection against the rulers. You know, so if you look at it purely from that angle, yes, it could be argued to be seditious. All right, but let's not give the Sedition Act any more time. They're supposed to get rid of it. They promised to get rid of it. Let's get rid of it, for goodness sake.
And the first way is by not using it at all.
Yes. Okay. Well, the Deputy Home Minister, Dato' Aziz Jamman, also criticised by own party members, fellow MPs, for also defending the Sedition Act. There is something, and I wonder if this has got to do with the nature of Pakatan itself. It was a coalition that came together with some of the parties, at least Bersatu, coming in very late.
Yeah.
Perhaps they haven't had an alignment of values, you know, that would help them be coherent or give a coherent message. Is that one possible reason?
Possible. I mean, but, you know, the incoherence is coming from PKR, which has always been a Pakatan party. Mm. If it was Bersatu insisting the Sedition Act be used, then we could sort of excuse them because most of them were formerly from UMNO and it's their habit to use the Sedition Act. But this is PKR. I mean, this guy must have some brains, right?
Well, that's what we presume. I think maybe a medical examination before anybody is allowed to become, you know, a candidate. But, you know, but on a serious note, the question of the anxiety that people have that free speech, open speech, will in fact lead to chaos, that groups will come out, they will have more noise on the streets, more contestation, and that we're not ready. Would you ever face this kind of pushback from your students who say, you know, Prof, if we had free speech, society might actually start to pull itself or tear it at itself?
But they've already had a law in ready to deal with that kind of stuff. Was it a Harmony Act or something like that? You know, they already had a bill prepared which would have dealt with hate speech, which would have dealt with situations where people incite hatred between the different communities, etc. So, you know, I think if you have a specific law, a very specific law to deal with that, it wouldn't really be a problem.
Right, but hate speech is very, very constrained, at least in the definition that they use globally, right? Yeah. In order that it doesn't impinge on freedom of expression. I mean, that's one of the things. Do you think, again, the question is, are we a society mature enough that we can handle the increased noise that comes from a democratic society?
I'm sure we can. I mean, look, May 9th happened without bloodshed, right? Was this country ever ready for a change of government?
Yep.
We always talked about it. We always feared there'll be bloodshed. We've always referred to May 1969. You know, we bring out all these old tropes once in a while and say we are not ready, we need to be the way we were. But we changed and without a drop of blood.
Let's not forget, I mean, also, there's a role to be played by the leadership of the country.
Yeah.
You know, if you allow the kind of horrible things which were being said by the red shirts and all that kind of people, and if you just let it go, you basically give them permission to do this. You legitimize them. So if the leadership is very clear on this, you know, and said, no, this is unacceptable, then the lunatic fringe will remain the lunatic fringe.
Yeah.
And then the rest of us can feel at least secure that the government of the day is against such things. You know, so there is a responsibility on them too.
To signal what is
to
the acceptable.
To make a signal, exactly.
Right. And the way that Donald Trump has...
Yeah, exactly.
It's going kind of a dog whistle that now has led to this massacre that we've seen
in
the synagogue, right?
Yeah.
But okay, there is a distinction, it's a subtle one, between somebody who has or engages in a kind of exclusionary kind of discourse, right? And people describe Zakir Naik, for instance, that controversial Indian televangelist who lives here. That's what he does. But he's not inciting violence. Now, how, and I don't know if that's a too subtle a distinction for many of us, because there are a lot of right-thinking liberal Malaysians who would like to see either Zakir Naik removed from this country or silenced.
Yeah.
I mean, how do we make that argument? Is that something that you agree with, this distinction?
No, I think the distinction is we got to get rid of hate speech. And sometimes we got to allow these guys around because, look, he's wanted in India, for example, right? Send him back if he's proven that he's done something wrong.
And the Indian government has failed on that, right?
And they've failed on that. Just like we have also failed to list people, red notice on Interpol. And so some people leave the country, for example. So it's all a matter of balance. And this country is we are just too much of a zero-sum game. Black or white, this or that. We can't see the nuances. We can't see it's all gray. And that we should be able to navigate this thing going forward. As Azmin said, it's leadership. And there seems to be a serious lack of leadership, whether in the old government and new government, to restrain and constrain these forces.
Yeah, Azmin, your charges have been dropped, I believe, have they?
Yes.
Oh, good. It is a new Malaysia. Okay. We still have things banned, by the way. There's some, you know, films and such banned. Is freedom of expression something that you feel palpably? I mean, when you look around and read the newspapers, do you feel that things have really changed in terms of how we talk and the information that you see coming out of the media?
I felt it on May 9th, on this channel itself.
Yeah.
You know, as the night progressed, you could see the glee in the eyes of the presenters. And you know, when they suddenly, you know, it was dawning on them that something weird was happening and people were being very critical on the show on that night. On that night itself, you could
feel
it.
Jabba, you're a media owner and you operate a media organization. Has it meant a real change for you? I mean, do you see it in terms of the constraints? Do you feel that things are off your back?
Yeah, I just think it's back to Wild Wild West. And for every journalist...
Wild Wild West?
Yeah, it's we have no sheriff, which is good. We've got to self-regulate, which is good. The greatest thing is to see freedom lighting in the eyes of... and dancing in the eyes of journalists who've always been under the cosh for so long. right? The guys in the mainstream papers, in private TV stations, finally asking questions, finally chasing down people, finally being a lot more intelligent than they let on when they before me. I think it's great, but it's greater competition for me and the rest of the guys because we've got to up our game. We've got to do more analytical work. We've got to keep two steps ahead of these chaps who now have the freedom.
All right, so now everybody can be critical.
Now, yeah, exactly.
Okay, we're going to be back with more. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. Welcome back to Let's Talk, a show that brings you the most important conversations of the day, and some of it involves shouting. Now, of course, it was young people demanding the resignation of the newly minted Minister of Education because they felt that he wasn't living up to the promise of university autonomy. Now, to help me understand this issue even better, I have in the room Azmi Sharam. He is a law lecturer at University of Malaya, and Jabir Sadiq, who is with the Malaysian Insight website portal. You are in university, and of course, you understand the dilemmas of reform. Reform takes time, and you outlined some of the conundrum, as it were, in fact, in a piece that you wrote. You call it tricky, the tricky road to university reform. Can you tell us what your argument was?
Right, okay. If you look at the laws that has to be changed, some of them will take a bit of time because it has to go through parliament, it has to be amended, it has to be a debate, etc. So specifically the University Colleges Act, all right? So that could happen. It could happen fairly quickly, but it's not going to happen now, all right? There are other laws like the Statutory Bodies Discipline Surcharge Act. That one, I argue, can happen very, very quickly, but that's not the topic here. We're talking about students. So, and university autonomy in general. The problem is that, like any institution, it's the staff. It's the people who run the institution which can be the problem, which can be the issue. Okay, so if you're looking at the university boards and the vice chancellors, you know, basically the top management of all universities was selected, handpicked by the previous government. So what do you do now? You know, I mean, if you give the board the kind of autonomy and power which it deserves, surely these people are going to be selecting the same kind of people to replace them, who might not be progressively minded, who might not care about freedom of expression and academic freedom, right? So what do you do? Do you give the board the power that they should have, or do you use your draconian powers now to just change everything temporarily, and after that, once you have a more independent-minded board, a more independent-minded vice-chancellors, then let them do their work.
Right. You know, so I'll be actually, I think this issue can be applied in many instances, yeah. Right? The principle versus the context and the complex and messy nature of the problem. What did you make of this fight that the young people took up because they felt that Mazli should not become, I think, president of UIA?
Yeah.
What do you think was going on in their minds, and how did you read the situation?
Well, it goes back to the manifesto, right? They promised all this autonomy. And I think it just came as a shock, one, that Mazli Malik is the education minister. Dr. Mahathir was supposed to be education minister. And two, then he decides...
Well, we had another principal intervening there.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. But we had another principal intervening there. And then so now Mazli Malik is the education minister. And, you know, from start, he said a lot of things, but the things that stuck to people's mind was black school shoes, lighter school bags, and then suddenly he makes himself president of UIA because he's got a sentimental attachment to this university. But he's education minister. He's got how many? I think there are too many universities in Malaysia now, public universities. So I wrote something about that too. And my point is, you're education minister. You got to take people from this primary school, right, through tertiary education, why just focusing on one university, right? But on the other principle is, of course, you shouldn't be interfering in an almost executive way in one university. I agree with the students. I don't agree with the way they did it, but I can see that point of view, you shouldn't be there at all.
I think that issue, I would like to think that they will be sympathetic to what I said just now. The issue is not so much that you're using your powers to select people to be in the boards, etc., but please, no politicians.
Yeah,
I think that's the key thing that they were.
So they didn't want the politicians, but and then there's this other rather difficult question, which is that talent. Do we have enough talent? And I think to fill all these positions. And if somebody does have political links, Art Harun, of course, I believe had links to Basatu and did some work for him. He's now the
He did work for UMNO.
Yeah, he did work for both parties.
Yeah,
both parties.
Yeah.
Okay, as a lawyer.
As a lawyer. Yeah.
So the question is, people, if you want to find people who are untainted, you know, didn't take positions, especially in a period in the run-up to G14, which was very polarized. People took positions. Everybody took positions, right?
I think there's a distinction to be made between those who take positions. Everybody has a position. Everybody has a right to take a position.
Yeah.
There's a distinction to be made between people like that and people who are actually politicians or actually ministers. I think there has to be a distinction made there.
Yeah, because he's an active politician.
And it's guys not just like, him, there's others as
there
well.
There are a lot of them. Like, I mean, but guys like us, we are politically exposed people because we know politicians. And Art acted for both sides or any side as a lawyer. That's fine. But he's not an active politician. If he was, I'd oppose that too.
Right? Well, you know, there are other issues, I guess, when it comes to principles and context, the messiness, and also the timeline for change. People are very impatient.
That's why it's very key that if you're going to use your powers now, but you intend to make changes, progressive changes later, it's very key to be transparent.
Yeah.
You know, this is what we plan to do. Eventually, after 2 years or whatever it is, this will be the system that we're going to put in place. But for now, it's not illegal. This is within our legal rights to do this, and this is what we're going to do.
Right, so a roadmap.
Yes, exactly.
And putting in people who can facilitate that change that you want later on.
So are the politicians just failing to communicate? They might actually have all this in their heads. They might have genuine or sincerely believe that they're doing something good, but they just don't seem to be communicating.
There's no clarity. There's no clarity in their thinking, or I don't think they even know what they want to do, really. But what's happening now is every brain fart is given out straight away rather than discuss in cabinet or anywhere else.
Right, so things bubble up to the surface, they explode.
Yeah.
Keep
going with the imagery, man.
Okay, I think there's something really interesting here, especially when it comes to policy formulation. It does seem we've had decades of people shooting from the hip. Basically, policies are formed when a journalist asks a question a minister has an idea. That's a great idea. It sounds like a great idea. Or somebody whispers into his or her ears, saying, hey, let me tell you a great idea.
Yeah.
It does seem like, well, at least with Muzley, he's, you know, ideas a minute, right?
Yes.
There's always something new.
Yeah.
20. Let me give you 24 ideas for reform. If you had the chance to start working with the universities, Azmi, what would you start with?
Vice-chancellors. The vice-chancellor sets the tone for the university. I mean, right now, there's still laws which can be used against students, against staff. Just don't use them.
Yeah.
You know, if make it very clear, like, these are the values of this university. We value academic freedom. We value student autonomy. We value staff autonomy. We value departmental autonomy. Make it very clear and just do your work based on those principles. You don't need anyone from the top telling you what to do. You don't need the law to be changed.
Yeah.
You just act in the right way. And that is determined very much by the vice chancellor. And, of course, the persons that he or she chooses.
I mean, Jabba, you know, if I gave you a chance to be the communications minister or the home minister, either one, what would you work at first for the media community?
Well, actually, I'd train the ministers first. I had this discussion many times with fellow journalists. I said I like the chaos right now because everything they say comes out. But I think as a government, there must be some minimum standards, some lines drawn. I think what's happening now is ministers don't know that they're ministers. They still think that, their tendency is just to tweet it out or whatever, right? They don't know that what they say has impact. not just on themselves, but their party, government, and people at large. And they're not testing it with their advisors. You know, I mean, Mazli is a good example, right? Like what you said, he's just absorbing all kinds of ideas and then putting it out. But he should test it with maybe his civil servants or fellow academics and say, what do you think of this?
But you've got to slow down a little bit.
He's got to slow down a lot. You know, it's only been 6 months next week, right? And it feels like it's almost a year, you know. Some of my friends are already using the word that starts with B and ends with Y, government. That's terrible. It's not even 6 months.
Okay, I'm going to have to think about that for a second. Yeah. In fact, take the next couple of minutes to think about what goes between a B and a Y, and we'll be back with Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin.
Aisen, apa pendirian kerajaan sekarang ni sama ada untuk meratifikasi Aisen konvensyen penghapusan semua kaum pada mulai tahun depan?
Kita akan sign setelah kita runding dengan semua kaum di Malaysia. Kita sebut dalam ucapan saya itu, iaitu perkara ini bukan mudah bagi Malaysia kerana di Malaysia terdapat pelbagai kaum masing-masing sensitif terhadap perkara-perkara tertentu.
Welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. In the room, I have Azmi Sharma, Professor of Law at University of Malaya, and also Jabar Sadiq, who's with the Malaysian Insight. We were just watching a little clip of Tun Dr. Mahathir, Prime Minister, speaking about the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. The government, and I think Tun at International Forest, said he was committed to signing all and ratifying all conventions in the United Nations. The question is, with this, you know, the difficulty of this particular one, because it does seem to be very emotive in nature. Perhaps, you know, Azmi, since you are a law professor, you could help us understand some of the niceties around 153, special position, and affirmative action.
Okay, firstly, I'm not a professor, but thanks for promoting me.
you should be.
I think apart from the fact that a lot of people are making it extremely volatile and emotional by bringing in religion. It's a treaty about race. Yeah. It's not a treaty about religion, but they're bringing it anyway. And, you know, it's all very high drama. Let's look at it as coolly as possible. The thing that some people are concerned about is that they feel that the special position of Malays and natives of Sabah and Sarawak, although they're never mentioned, will be threatened if we are party to the Convention Against Racial Discrimination. But that's not necessarily true, because the convention actually allows for affirmative action, right? And that is what essentially Article 153 is. Article 153 of the Constitution is permission for the government of the day to go against Article 8. Article 8 is about equality, but Article 8 says you can be unequal if it's specifically allowed for in the Constitution, which is what Article 153 is. So it allows for certain quotas to be set for the civil service, for scholarships, etc. That's okay, because the convention allows for that, as long as it fits certain criteria. Firstly, it cannot be forever, right? It's for a particular purpose, to help a particular group of people. Secondly, it has to be reasonable. And I think the Constitution says that. The Constitution says that these provisions, the AGONG can, on advice, can make these special provisions as long as it's reasonable. When we are all okay, surely it's not reasonable anymore to treat people differently. Or are these people saying that they want to be treated like weak, needy people forever? Is that what they're saying?
Well, okay, so they might have a particular purpose. The people who brought the coffin to Parliament as protest, it was about 100 people. But, you know, there was something quite interesting in the little clip that we watched just now from Tun, when he says we need a negotiation between the races. Now, it's an interesting expression, because what exactly does that mean? Who is having this negotiation? Who becomes representative? I mean, you can't bring everybody to the table. There are 32 million of us, you know, and and so on and so forth. I mean, what do you make of expressions like that coming from politicians?
Well, I think just to buy time, really, if anything, because Dr. Mahathir is the master politician, of course. And he's saying two things, really. One, he's trying to buy time to allay fears of certain groups. And two, I think he's trying to say that we've never had this conversation before. We've always put it behind closed doors. So everything has been top down or civil society pressure, right? So he's buying time and says, well, maybe I need to have a chat, or we need to have a chat with the Sabahans and Sarawakians, the ones who are the Orang Aslis in Peninsula, because what are their voices? And Azmi is right. We've always talked about the Malays on the 153. Never talk about the natives. You know, I mean, I think it's unfair that I need a stamp to go to Sabah and Sarawak, and I need a work permit to work there. I reasonable time to allow them to come up to speed, fine. But we've been a country for 50 years. How much more time do they need?
I mean, Azmi, are there complications around our constitution? I mean, in fact, the nature of our country. I think many of us forget it's a federal system. We don't actually understand the full implications of what a federal system is. You know, how much, in some ways, the central government cannot impose its will, as Mahathir did, on the question of the age limit, the marriage limit of 18. Yeah. Mm. You know, he didn't kind of imposed it on all the Pakatan states. He said, I want you to see this pass. Yeah. Now, should, you know, do you think we understand enough about how our country actually works, the architecture of it?
Okay. Firstly, let's deal with the federal-state issue, right? The powers of the federal government, the powers of the state government are quite clearly laid out in the Constitution. And the federal government does have the power to basically overrule state jurisdiction if the purpose is to implement international obligations, right? But they don't necessarily have to use that power. And they, as far as I can tell, they have never used it in that way, all right? Now, with regards to understanding the Constitution, understanding our framework, there isn't any. Okay, and sometimes I think it's a willful decision to pretend to be ignorant and to use the most horrible language, the most horrible type of discourse in order to fan the flames of anger, etc., for your own nefarious political purposes, which is actually wrong in the context of what is actually allowed by our Constitution.
Right. I mean, there are people, obviously, who are opposed to this government politically and are going to use every opportunity to malign it and try and bring it down and so on, destabilize it and such. But don't you think there are also a good number of people who truly, not for any political reasons, but don't understand the complexities, or would like to say, because they have a progressive social agenda, would like a strong state, central government, to impose its will on others? So, for instance, in the Trogano case of caning those two young women, right?
Yeah, yeah.
There was a demand that the central government intervene, and we did not have, in fact, the central government intervening. It could not.
Yeah, it could not because of the Constitution, right? And also, I think that's willful ignorance again, that you know the federal government can't interfere because it's an Islamic law issue, and that's a matter of the state. I think people actually know what's going on, but they willfully ignore, as Azmi says, for their own interests, right? And I think the unfortunate consequence of this is huge misunderstanding amongst the people, and then you will find the conservative folks in Terengganu or Kelantan will just dig in even further, and the chasm will just be, it just grow wider.
That's why it's so important that there has to be discourse, particularly in Malay, to talk about these kinds of things in a detached manner, to lay down what exactly the law is, what is allowed, what is not allowed, you know, so that people have a better understanding.
So kind of literacy around the context.
Yeah. Well, yes, sure. But I'm not talking about having literacy courses and stuff like that. That's not workable, right? But, you know, I think there's a responsibility on the part of the media, for example, to allow for this kind of discourse to happen so that, you know, there's more information as opposed to more entertainment which is going out there.
But is, you know, and this, you know, I sometimes, and maybe in my more pessimistic mode, think that individuals aren't interested to do the investment in time to understand things more accurately. Because it's almost easy to take a position. Mm. You could take a position without necessarily having full understanding of something.
Well, most people do, right?
I mean, and Facebook and all social media facilitates
because
that.
We are forced to give an opinion almost immediately. We put pressure on ourselves to lay an opinion and be part of a conversation without even finding out anything about that conversation. In a world where a news cycle is 5 seconds, and opinion cycle is even quicker than that, people just blab it out or follow the mob and just say what they want to say. Right? Mob rule is such like that. That I'm Muslim, I'm Malay, therefore, ipso facto, I have to behave this way. Mm. Otherwise, I'll go to hell.
In fact, there's an entry in this book of yours, Azmi, called We Must Not Let a Mob Rule. I mean, we must not allow for mob rule. But how do we prevent it?
Okay. Basically, democracy does not mean that the majority is right all the time. Okay, because there has to be certain ground rules in any society which cannot be broken. Okay, so for example, our right to life. If the majority of people think that police should be able to shoot us at will, that cannot be allowed.
With ponytails.
Yes, people with ponytails. Yeah. Kill those with ponytails. You know, that should not be allowed. All right? So there has to be certain very, very strong ground rules. That's what I meant, really. And then, and again, like what I said earlier, there has to be this element of leadership. Right? So when faced with this issue of the, for example, the Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, surely it's also important for the government to say, look, we've looked at the issues, and this is what we think, you know, and this is how our laws, our constitution is not going to be affected because of whatever reason, you know. Have a measured, reasonable response. And then it's harder for those who are out there specifically to look for trouble. It's harder for them to get a foothold. Because, you know, look, at the end of the day, Malaysians actually do still look up to their leaders, right? So, in a way it's bad, in a way it's good. Because if you are responsible enough, if you're intelligent enough, you can actually help calm down a lot of situations with a bit of intelligence and a lot of reason.
Okay, Azmi Sharom, who is an assistant professor at University of Malaya, and also Javed Sadiq, who is the editor-in-chief of the Malaysian Insight. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. Let's talk with me, Sharad Kutin. Welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. We, in fact, have a bit of breaking news. Tim Leiser of Goldman Sachs has pleaded guilty on one MDB charge. And Joe Law, and we believe also an individual called Roger Ng, are going to be charged for the one MDB case in the US. We have Ibrahim Sani to help us understand what this all means. Ibrahim, what do we have?
All right, so there's you're right, there is breaking news right now, currently happening in the U.S. Tim Leisner has pleaded guilty to charges of conspiring on money laundering. And in the process of him pleading guilty, he will forfeit $43.7 million to the government of the United States. That's about 180 million ringgit. In the meantime, Roger Ng, who is also a former Goldman Sachs employee, has been hit by three charges. Much of it relates to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, or FCPA, and all this is also related to 1MDB. Roger Ng has been detained by the Malaysian authorities earlier today. And he was detained using warrant of arrests that were issued by the request of the United States government to the Malaysian police. So the Malaysian police arrested Roger Ng using the warrant of arrest that was requested by the U.S. And it's not sure what the treatment is on Roger Ng, whether he will be extradited from Malaysia into the U.S., but from where we stand, it clearly looks like it, because he was arrested using a warrant of arrest requested by the U.S., and he is already being indicted or charged today in a New York court, so it seems very likely that he will see legal proceedings in the U.S. Meanwhile, the central character of the lot, Joe Low, is still at large.
Okay, thank you so much. That was Ibrahim Sani. We'll come back with more news as the story develops. Back to my studio guests, Jabba Sadiq from the Malaysian Insight, as well as Azmi Sharom from University of Malaya. Interesting times indeed. Who would have guessed that while you're on this show, momentous things were happening? And we will get closer and closer to the truth, I guess, with these revelations. Are you surprised, Jaba, by any of these things?
No, I mean, the previous government was exceptional in many things. They did say people's first performance now, and they keep performing.
They keep performing. Okay, it's more like a theatrical show, isn't it? With high drama to be expected. Is this something, I mean, coming back to the fact that you teach, do you talk about 1MDB to your students? Do you actively engage in a discussion with them about its implications, what it means for governance especially?
Of course, I mean, if it's relevant to what I teach, I mean, fortunately, I teach human rights. So there's a lot of stuff that happens in Malaysia which is utterly irrelevant to what I teach. I think there is a danger of us forcing our views onto our students, and you don't want to do that either. So if you're going to bring stuff like this in, you make sure it's relevant.
Outside the syllabus, and they could be examined.
It has to have something to do with, you know. Let's give me one example, right? A lot of these UMNO fellas are saying that it's political persecution. It's not. It's a crime.
Yeah.
You've committed a crime, and it's not political persecution because you're going to be faced in a court. You're going to have lawyers to defend you. There should be a fair trial. I hope there will be a fair trial. You have every chance to defend yourself. That's not political persecution.
So it's prosecution, not persecution.
Right.
I know you work with indigenous people, also transboundary pollution issues with the law, public interest litigation. I looked at your CV.
That's a long time ago. But yeah.
Okay, all of which will be perhaps more relevant. I'm very interested in the question of public interest litigation in Malaysia and the possibilities that it will open up the conversation and force us to look more closely at what happens in the country.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Indo-Water case, I think, is the one that basically overruled the Lim Kit Siang Supreme Court decision, which now opens up the whole spectrum of the possibility of more public interest litigation. Because what happened after the Lim Kit Siang case in the 88 was there's a very narrow band of people who can bring someone to court, who can bring the government to court.
Others don't have a local standard.
Exactly,
thing.
They don't have standing, right? But since that particular case, the Indo-Water case, the question of standing has been broadened again. So the possibility is there. I think it's good because, you know, sometimes you, the only route you have is to go to the court.
You know, this question of conversation, and we keep coming back. I mean, conversation means different things in different contexts. But for the media, the kind of conversations, and I want to remind everybody what you said earlier, you know, Bangsa divided by a highway between Kampung Kerinci and the leafy neighborhoods, right? How do we set that conversation going?
Don't know, you know, I think just no one's listening to each other, really. There's no conversation because no one's
but
listening to each other.
But can the media be the bridge? Can the media be an honest broker in the kind of conversations we're now having in Malaysia?
I think the media is an honest broker, really. But depends on the language, too. You know, if everything's in English, the chaps across the highway, you know, they don't want to, they can't speak English because of education. So we have to speak them in Bahasa. But we look down on them and we say, okay, let's put it in Bahasa, right? So we've got all kinds of social class and different demographics going on that there's no one arbiter. You know, this is a very unique country in that sense. We are divided by so many things. United only by, our affection for the tanah air and food. But other than that, we just, you know, we completely, you know, the guys in Bangsa just want to have their cheesecake. The guys in Kampung Kerinci want to have their chokodo.
I thought it was the quinoa that we were looking at. I say, cutting my waistline.
Yeah.
But okay, in the remaining minute or so that we have, Azmi, what are your hopes? I mean, you wrote this book titled Brave New World. It, in fact, is upon us. Not fully developed, but it's upon us. What would you like to see?
Well, I'd like to see that we progress in a way where our democracy becomes more strong and secure, and that there could be voices across the board where you're free and safe to share more ideas, hopefully more in BM as well.
Yes.
I hope there's a greater, more progressive BM press so that, you know, the word, different words get out, right? We've been too used to only hearing one particular angle, one particular voice, right? Particularly when it comes to race, particularly when it comes to religion. Yeah. You know, there's just not enough there. And when you don't have that, those kinds of choices, you know, that's when problems happen.
Okay, I'm going to turn to you as, you know, I hope you play the cynical journalist or not, if you'd like. Reversal, the possibility of reversal. Uh-huh. Do you see that in the next two, three years, the possibility of reversal, that we might actually return? Because it happens in many countries. They have a breakthrough, they have reversals.
I don't see a reversal as yet. I think what's unique about May 9th was not just the people who voted, but also the people who did not go out to vote because they were angry with their own party. I don't see things changing right now in the next 3-4 years because the parties that were government are in shambles. They're brittle. One loss and they collapse like some, I don't know what. You know,
a
house of cards. It just collapsed just like that. All parties, right? I think we will go along this track, maybe because there's still faith in Dr. Mahathir, and subsequently the next prime minister, and then. But what will happen is after that, you know, 8 years from now, when I think the presumptive prime minister Anwar Ibrahim reaches 80 years old, right? What happens after that? Who's the next chap taking over the baton? What would his policies be?
And
or her? Hopefully it's a her, you know, for once, or someone from Sabah, Sarawak, really, taking it forward. And then that person is crucial. Because the voters now, the 16-year-olds now, are the ones who are going to dominate and decide who runs the country.
Whatever it is, we must not be complacent with our democracy. Yeah. Let's look what happened to Thailand. Let's look what happened in the Philippines. We must not get complacent.
Okay, No complacency. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Jaber Sadiq, Azmi Sharam, they've been wonderful guests. And remember, and Let's Talk with Sharad Crittenden comes to you every night at 10 p.m. only on Astro One.